You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Well, hello again, everyone. This is Leadership Powered by Common Sense, and I'm your host, Doug Thorpe. Today, we're going to turn the table a little bit and dive into the financial side of business. I have a very special guest who has some interesting information to share with us. His name is Ian Schnoor. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Doug. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
Ian, as we met, we talked a lot about his background and his activity, and he is in the, I'll call it the deep end of the pool with financial modeling, financial analysis, and certifications of those skills. But before we get into all that, Ian, can you just sort of recap your journey to get where you are today?
Yeah, I'd love to, Doug, and I'll keep it as brief as I can. I did an undergraduate degree in business and started my career in investment banking. And I spent about 6 years at BMO and then and at Citibank doing traditional corporate finance, mergers and acquisitions, helping companies with cross-border financings, those sorts of things. This is the late 90s, sort of the Wild West of Excel and spreadsheets and modeling. I was always one of the young analysts that liked to kind of push the envelopes and to challenge the conventional thinking around the way tools should be built in spreadsheets. And when I left banking after about 6 years, I just wanted a bit of a break. I thought I would go back to banking at some point. So the break has turned out to be over 20 years at this point, and I haven't gone back yet. But I started, because I always liked thinking about models and modeling, I started a business around 20 years ago called the Marquee Group that provides training in financial modeling. And after starting it up, it picked up very, very rapidly and saw demand all over the world. So we have a team of around 20, 25 people that run training courses, mostly at banks, pension funds, large companies, to account groups of accountants, groups of finance professionals, to help them with financial modeling, forecasting, advanced Excel skills, valuation. And so we've been doing that and to a lot of really enjoy that for literally 20 years ago. And about 5 years ago, started a second business, noticed that there was a big change in the world of forecasting and modeling and spreadsheet work. And that change was as follows. You know, when I started, recruiters were looking for people that were smart and had, you know, a good head on their shoulders. But around 5-7 years ago, a lot of job postings changed and started saying, we're looking for people with, you know, I don't know, a CPA or an MBA or CFA, but we also want people with proven financial modeling skills. And that's what they would say. We want people who have strong modeling skills because there was no way to prove you had modeling skills. So they just said, we need people that have that. And then it was up to the candidate to figure out how to demonstrate it. And we realized that there was a real gap. The world was craving an accreditation, a way to validate these skills. And so a whole bunch of us from around the world created another organization, totally independent, called the Financial Modeling Institute, the FMI. And think of the FMI, the Financial Modeling Institute, sort of like CPA or CMA or CFA. We are an accreditation body that creates very challenging, rigorous tests, puts people through them in a controlled, proctored environment so that we can prove that people have exceptional skills. That's a little bit of who I am. And so I've really been passionate in thinking about models, modeling, and strong decision-making for my entire career.
Well, you and I kind of have a little bit of a similar background, albeit in my case. Let me first say what I mean is we spent some years in banking, and I go so far as to call myself a recovering banker, and I have fundamentally no desire to get back in there. But I saw too many things changing too fast for the way I learned how to be a banker, and just wanted to leave it up to other guys now. But no doubt the modeling was a big element of the work we did. Sure. And more importantly, it was a kind of a request or requirement on our customers. So The reason I got excited about having you on the show when we first met was the idea that as I do my own work in the small business realm, I advocate a kind of a three-pillar model of helping a business owner. I break everything down in one of three simple buckets. It's either people, process, or profits. And yep. the profits is the area where your specialty connects. And what I mean by that is, and what I tell my small business clients is, whatever they think they know about their numbers, they probably need to know more.
Yeah.
And unless somebody has come into an entrepreneurship and started a business after being a banker or a financial modeler or an analyst or some kind of financial control kind of person, they probably have no fundamental clue of what the key metrics are and the key values they ought to be looking for and tracking in those numbers.
That's largely true. Yeah, there's a lot of that. I agree for sure.
So, but we take that on up a notch as the enterprise gets bigger and bigger. There's obviously more complex challenges to understand. So I will start with just kind of a first question. If you think of the spectrum of how a business comes out of the garage and turns into an enterprise, is there an inflection point that you think of that somebody ought to start thinking about the level of modeling and analysis that you work with?
Yeah, I mean, listen, we are huge advocates, you know, and we really just to answer that question, should just very quickly define what a model is. A model is purely and simply a forecast. That's it. And we're doing that to try and forecast a business. Now, my strong belief is that any business venture should have a forecast. The level of detail and complexity of the forecast can change and evolve over time as the detail and complexity of the business evolves. But it is really critical. What it does is a good forecast gives you tremendous insight into what the future might look like or what could happen. And it allows you to do optimal planning for your business. A model is not a crystal ball. What it does is it says, well, if this and this happens, what could the future potentially look like? You know, if you're starting off in your garage making, I don't know, some sort of a product or a machine, what the model does, and this is a famous quote that I love to talk about, is, you know, plans mean nothing, but planning is everything, right? And what the model does is it forces you to think about all the critical aspects of your business, right? Sometimes people think that a financial model is this required, boring exercise where you take last year's financial statements that your accountant prepared and you project them out into the future. Nothing could be further from the truth. A model that we build is what we refer to as a drivers-based model. It allows you to think about what the business might look like. So I could give you hundreds of examples. One example recently was I was helping an organization. It was a few women actually trying to start a small gym, and they wanted to open up a gym, a women's only gym. And the modeling process allowed them to really think hard about, okay, how much are you going to charge? What do you think is reasonable? What do you think the market will bear? How are you going to charge? Is it going to be on a per use basis? Is it going to be on a monthly basis? Okay. What's the capacity? How many people can you actually fit? All right. What will your costs be? How many staff do you have to have? What will be the technology costs? What will the security costs be? Okay. Are you going to have any debt? What will your capital costs be? Do you have any working cap? And it forced us to work through and think about all the issues that would be revolved in them running a business. And to say, and then they could say, huh, really? If we do all that, we're not going to make any money. And I said, that's right. You're not going to make any money if that happens. So you're going to have to double the volumes you thought, or find a way to pay people less, or pay a lot less in rent. But you can't make money that way. And they're like, wow, okay, that's interesting. Okay, let's go back to the drawing board. And it allows you to really think hard and push about the business idea.
Yeah. And what comes to my mind, and I've certainly experienced this in my own business life in the past, is that, you know, for a smaller business, the immediate forecast that needs to get looked at is capacity. And, you know, with every incremental increase in some kind of capacity, you load up the cost side of your numbers.
Yeah.
And to your point, if the revenue opportunity doesn't adequately offset that and create a profit margin, why are you doing that? You know, why are you just adding space or adding headcount or adding equipment and facility to do something that as the famous banker quote says, when you're losing money, you can't make it up in volume.
That's right. People try. And you know, it, again, what a model does is it forces you to think, you know, in true business terms. It's not a model is not a financial tool. It's a business tool. All business owners need to think about their business and what the business might look like. And so when you talk about capacity, we like to characterize that all companies have three categories of costs. There's really only three types of costs any business might ever have. There's your true variable costs. Those are the ones, you know, like if you're a pizza restaurant, the cost of dough, right? Every pizza requires a certain amount. Doesn't matter how many pizzas you make, you're going to have a certain type of dough, and you're going to have to buy X quantity of dough for every pizza you want to make. That's variable. You're going to have a fixed cost, like your rent. Your monthly rent is fixed. It stays rent regardless. But then you're going to have some costs that will be step function, or you're going to hit a capacity. You can always grow, but you might have to, you know, go beyond. So at a certain point, you might only be able to make, you know, 10,000 pizzas a year because your ovens can only handle that. Okay. And beyond that, you need to invest in a whole additional oven, and then you need another person to staff that oven. And so you're right. So and we don't have to get into that, but what a model does is it says at certain inflection points, what do we need to do to make different business decisions? And can we survive those decisions? And you know what? When someone has a great grasp on their forecast, their model, they have great insight into their business, and it gives them so much more confidence making appropriate business decisions, and they're grounded decisions, and they're factually grounded, and that's the purpose. I always tell people that the number one reason for building good models is to enable optimal decision-making, all sorts of decision-making. It's not just for your banker or your accountant. It's for everyone running their business.
I like that. And I often tell owners that when they're looking at what would be a forecast if they had prepared one, but if they're just looking out over the horizon at what may be coming, a lot of times they get presented some big opportunity, some whale of an account that is just going to monumentally increase their top side revenue. So they get all focused on that and they get all excited about that. But then those decisions that have to get made about that incremental deal, I have to buy another oven to be able to serve that client. Sure. I like that example.
The classic example is, you know, a smaller manufacturer or a small business, you know, gets an account with Walmart, and they get very excited because they're going to distribute massive volumes into Walmart. But of course, Walmart wants the absolute lowest price that you can offer to them, which means suddenly you have to staff up and take on a loan to increase your capacity, and you need to hire more people, and they don't pay very quickly at times. So, you know, then you've got massive working capital needs because you're investing in inventory and more people, but you're not going to get your cash. And a lot of companies get strained when you're right, when they get a big contract and struggle to execute and deliver on it.
Well, that raises a good question. And you know, the banker in me and the advisory kind of work I do, inevitably, when I walk into a new shop, I ask, the very first question I ask is, do they have a cash forecast model? You know, where's your cash coming from? Where does it have to go? How are you doing with that? And of course, the majority of small businesses don't think about that. They've got a classic idea of profit and loss,
right,
income statement, but they don't have that cash flow model and forecast to work with. So are there some baseline recommended models that you would advise a business owner to focus on first? Obviously, the end game's wide open. There's hundreds of ideas that you could get into, but what do you think are some of the core basic ideas they ought to focus?
Well, you know, I'm going to talk about, so there's no perfect answer to the right level of detail. And when you think about a forecast, there's two dimensions of detail that you want to think about. There's what we call the level of rows. That's like what we refer to as the operating detail. But then there's also the detail in the column structure. And we refer to that as the model's periodicity, and think about how much timing detail is appropriate. Now, for a small business, I always think it's helpful to have sort of at least a 3-year forecast. 3 to 5 years is normal, and I would say go out 5 years. I mean, it might be difficult. It might be a stretch to think, you know, when you're newer, about years 4 to 5, but it's not a bad exercise to think about what could we look like if we sort of hit some of our targets and what might the business look like. So 5 years is nice to think about a medium-term range in the future. You might have to do some sort of evaluation if you're attracting investors. You might, if you want to rent space, you might have to show a landlord what a 3 to 5 year forecast looks like. But also from a cash flow management standpoint, it's always nice to, you know, in concert, have sort of a 1 year, 12-month rolling 12-month cash flow forecast. Now, if you happen to have a large bank line and bank facility that you can borrow when you need to, that might be less important. But if you are like a lot of small businesses that every month or so, you're like, are we going to be able to pay our bills and pay our people? And do we have to call some customers and say, can you pay us a week faster? Because if you're really close to running out of cash, like a lot of businesses, then yeah, it's really important to have a monthly, and which just shows that's less about revenue and expenses and more about what's coming in and what's going out, right, in a given month. I don't care that I've sold $1 million to Walmart. If I'm not getting that for 90 days, well, my cash inflow is zero for the next 3 months, and I still have to figure out how to pay my bills, in that interim period.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a critical part of this idea of being able to have some visibility and insight into the business and where they're going with it. Wow, my mind is on fire here. I'm thinking of so many different things that yes. come into this. And maybe I need to take my banker geek hat off for a minute and just try to get back to the basics of running that business. So, you know, there are obviously a lot of tools that small business owners get into. For instance, you know, a very popular solution is QuickBooks.
Yes.
To run that. And it has a degree of some of this forecasting and modeling, particularly on the cash flow, although there's some devil in the details there. Can you just sort of address the effort to stand one of these up appropriately for a small business without it becoming overwhelming to them?
Sorry, stand up a
forecast model or tool.
Sure.
Or,
I got to tell you, there are only two ways to build a forecast. One is to use a piece of pre-built software. We call it black box software. And I'm going to lump QuickBooks and other accounting software into that mix.
Good.
And the other way is to kind of open up a white piece of paper. And in computer parlance, we call that a spreadsheet. Very often it's Excel. My recommendation is certainly for smaller businesses starting off is just to use a spreadsheet. There are lots of software packages like QuickBooks that do have the capacity to build a forecast. The challenge is that QuickBooks was built and designed to record actual data, your historicals. So most companies do have a bookkeeper or someone who assists with bookkeeping. And you know as well as I do, bookkeeping can get very granular and very detailed in the way you enter it, because not only do you need it to file your annual statements, but you need it for tax filing purposes, for tax collections. So there's a lot of detail that's needed in there just to record your actuals, to make sure that your statements are correct. Number one, you don't always need that level of detail to forecast in the future. And number two, it requires having a decent amount of skill to go into that software and be able to use it to try and generate some sort of a forecast. Our recommendation is open up a sheet of paper. We call it Excel, call it a spreadsheet, and just jot down. I mean, almost everyone has some comfort level with Excel. Here's the good news. You don't need to have phenomenal Excel skills or spreadsheet skills to build a decent forecast. It's about thinking about what drives your business and getting the level of detail that will, like as an example, you know, in QuickBooks, you probably have one line for just labor expense and all labor expense goes into a line perhaps. But in a forecast, you might want to think about the different roles, truck drivers and opera, and how many of these operators do I need and how many line people and how many of this do I need and do I think I want? And that might not be the way you need your data to be populated historically. may not be what you want to think about to forecast and make business decisions into the future. So there's nothing wrong with having an independent tool. You can populate the spreadsheet with your actuals that come right out of QuickBooks. And then starting from there, think about how do I want to drive my business going forward? It makes you as a business owner very intelligent and very insightful about your business to really talk about all the driving forces that will dictate and impact your future.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point in the notion of using a standard tool like a QuickBooks to try to do some of this modeling, because to your point, it's more historical data. And while you want to know where you're standing today, first challenge is your bookkeeping up to date, or do you have a 3-month backlog on it? You know, do you,
right.
are you working with that? So more importantly is the idea of let's think through the critical variables that come into the equation here when I'm looking at my business. If I've got a people capacity issue, you know, one employee can only handle so many widgets, transactions, or units per day. And yes. If I want to triple the number of units I'm selling, I need three total people doing it, right?
Yeah.
So it's those kind of variables and the dynamic with that input that is the more critical element of the modeling, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And having the creative license to think through that and to design that and to mock it up and scratch it out in your spreadsheet and try something different gives you the great insight. Ah, this is what will happen. Well, maybe we can apply what if we train people and we spend, you know, 20,000 and we train them and we can get, instead of them making 10 units a day, we can get everyone to make 15 units, and you can try to play with that on a spreadsheet. And what happens if we can do that? And oh, okay. Like you can really see that trying to back jig your accounting software to help you do that is just going to cause headaches and you won't do it.
That's but allow.
Allows you a nice spreadsheet, allows you to think, and allows you. And I got to tell you, some of the biggest, most sophisticated companies on the planet, and I've spoken to some of the CFOs, have told me that they use spreadsheets to forecast their own multi-billion-dollar businesses for the same reason, because they want the flexibility to say, what if this? What if we change that? What if we learn? What if we modify this and change that or do this or do that? What does that make us look like? That's how we talk when we think about the future. What if? What if? Right? The past is just about reconciling what happened. Nobody says what if about the past because it's done. But we want to make decisions to play with things in the future, and we need some flexibility. Any black box software will never have the flexibility that any business owner wants to think about permutations and changes.
I like that. Well, Ian, I tell you what, man, we're kind of up at a break point here. We're going to take a short pause. And I do want to shift gears when we come in on the other side. We're going to talk some more about slightly bigger enterprise and what leaders and managers need to be thinking about for their modeling and analysis at that level. So we'll be right back after this message. Thanks.
Business is all about solving complex problems as fast as you can create them. Become the best problem solver by leading others to greatness too. And the first step is going to DougThorpe.com. Doug Thorpe is known globally for coaching entrepreneurs and business leaders, improving their performance and the work output of everyone surrounding them. You can find health, wealth, and happiness by learning to lead others to health, wealth, and happiness. Go to DougThorpe.com now and order Doug's books or hire him to coach your managers. That's Doug, T-H-O-R-P-E.com.
Well, hello again, everyone. We're back. Today, I'm visiting with Ian Schnoor. We are talking about the discipline of financial modeling and analysis. When we talked in the first half of the show, we were kind of focused on the small business entrepreneur realm, but I know there are those of you out there in the audience that are responsible for larger teams, larger enterprise and activities. And when you are there and there's some more zeros on the schedule, this whole notion of the value of this modeling and analysis gets more prevalent. So one of the first things I'd like to talk about, Ian, you pointed out in your backstory that you and some colleagues around the world noticed a gap in the market in terms of individuals that could represent some solid skills, experience, and qualifications to do this modeling and do this forecasting. So talk to us a little more about that particular gap that you discovered.
You know, I'll put, there's an analogy, a story I like to share. Think about any, you've been involved, Doug, I'm sure, in a lot of instances where clients have sold their business or purchased a business, right? A typical, you know, M&A or acquisition scenario. And certainly as you get in, I mean, I started my career working in that world, in the mergers and acquisitions world. Think about a typical situation where a medium or large business is buying another large business. Think of all the professionals that are involved to help facilitate that transaction. Of course, you've got the management teams on both sides, but then they always need to bring in a team of externals to help process the transaction, including lawyers, right? We all, you know, work with lawyers. You're going to have accountants on the transaction that help get all the numbers ready. You're going to have perhaps engineers. If it's a technical business, there'll be engineers doing due diligence. You might have actuaries involved to help evaluate pension plans and the status of, you know, labor and pension situations. And you got some bankers that are going to help with the forecasting and the valuation work, right, et cetera. So you got a lot of different people brought in. Every single one of those professionals has a university, some sort of an education, and an external validation of their profession that they have the skills needed, except for the finance professional. The accountant, you cannot practice as an accountant unless you have a background, an education, a university education, and you need to get a professional certification. Same thing with the actuary, the engineer, the lawyer. You can't practice law unless you are, you know, certified and have passed the bar. Except the person who's doing the financial work and building the so critical financial model could be some random person who, you know, has any background, and there's no way to know that that critical skill is being built by someone who's truly passed the rigorous test and has got the skills needed. And there are so many mistakes and so many valuation errors get made because someone built an inappropriate, improper forecasting tool. So we are out there for the last few years trying to fill that gap and getting a lot of excitement. As an example, the former CEO of the CFA Institute, right, the global accreditation organization in finance based in Charlottesville, Virginia. I've been there a few times. So his name is Paul Smith. He's British. He lives in Hong Kong. He's joined our team. He's joined our board. He's very excited. One of the former CEOs of one of the divisions at Kaplan, most people have heard of Kaplan, has joined our team and our board because these guys saw such a demand and need in their prior lives for people to have really strong modeling skills. And we're trying to achieve that at the Financial Modeling Institute, the FMI.
Very good. Very good. So that would bring a level of credentialing that companies then, when they're going out to hire these people on their staff, exactly. That's yet another measure of something they could look to have a degree of
exactly.
Comfort.
Yeah, exactly. I told you that a lot of job postings now, employers will say, we want, I don't know, a CPA, MBA, and someone with strong modeling skills. Our goal is in a number of years, they'll say we want a CPA, you know, CFA, and an AFM. AFM is our first level accreditation. It's our level one. It stands for Advanced Financial Modeler. And anyone who's passed our level one AFM exam has exceptional financial modeling skills. They have built up a financial model in an exam setting in under 4 hours from scratch with no resources, no internet. And they're connected to the internet, but they have no external resources. They're not looking at anything. They've learned and mastered the skill. And that would be proof to a prospective employer that you've got those skills.
That sounds wonderful. again, I'm reflecting back on my days in the bank. One of the things we did for someone who hired on, you know, say maybe straight out of college and they wanted to, you know, quote, become a banker, they went through what we called at the time a credit training program. But the real root of that, the core of that whole program was teaching the financial analysis and modeling method that we had directed as the right answer for looking at a prospective bank customer, look at their loan package, look at their financials.
Yes.
And do what bankers call spreading, you know, spread all those numbers into a bit of a standard format that then everybody on the inside of the bank could look at and help inform the decision they wanted to make about approving that loan or asking for some other consideration or modification to it.
Yeah, credit, you know, credit professionals have historically done a much better job. There is no accreditation in the field of credit either, as you know. Banks tend to do it. So banks have kind of taken it on. Some of the credit rating agencies have tried to implement a formal accreditation in the credit space, but it hasn't caught on, you know, either. But the banks all put their credit bankers through a very extensive training program that can be months. And I guess because, you know, in the credit world, there's not tons of upside. The upside means you get back, you know, what you thought, but there's a lot of downside. So they want to make sure that no one makes a mistake. And so, yes, that does happen. But we are trying to formalize it on the modeling side to know that those building models are truly skilled and prepared to do that work.
I know we talked about some of the essentials of what makes a model, and you said in very simple terms, it's a kind of a forecast. That's really all we're talking about.
Yep.
But as we do look to bigger enterprise type modeling tools, what are some of the other elements and factors that come into play that make this so darn complex at times?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. People often use the word complex. I tend to not like to use that word. I tend to like to say that as companies get bigger, they become more detailed. And sure, I mean, there is, and you can rephrase that or reframe that. If you've got six manufacturing facilities and you're shipping and moving things all over the world, sure, there's a complexity there. But people sometimes think the models have to become a lot more difficult. It's not true. They become a little bit bigger. They become longer. There becomes more detail. But if a model's not well, listen, if your model's only 100 lines long, it should be pretty easy to keep it straightforward. What we, you know, share at the FMI, and we're looking to incorporate strong discipline. Our message is it doesn't matter if your forecast is 100 rows of a spreadsheet or 10,000 rows. It still needs to adhere to the same discipline and the same principles so that it can be used. And yes, you might have a lot more people and you might have a lot more costs and you might have different divisions globally. But the point is those large global businesses, they still sell things, right? They effectively function exactly the same way. They sell something, a product or a service. They have different costs. The costs will still be marketing costs and people costs and energy costs. And they have capital costs and interest charges. It's just, as you said, there's just more of them and there's just more zeros and it's bigger. It doesn't mean it has to be harder. It just means it needs a little bit better planning, a little bit more flow and a little bit more organization so that it does not become a mess. One of the biggest challenges is that financial forecasts, as they get longer and they get more detailed, often become a huge mess. And it makes it very difficult for people to therefore make good decisions. I'm sure in your banking days, you saw more than your fair share of horrible, messy spreadsheets.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the other thing about it is the more cumbersome they get like that, you're right. Number one, the big risk is that error gets introduced. But what I see from a leadership standpoint, people start looking at some of the substance and content and mass of detail, and they sort of immediately check out. And it reminds me of the old phrase, a confused mind says no.
Yes.
If the leader is not comfortable looking at the report, it might be natural for them to say, well, how do we get here? What went into that? What were your assumptions? What did you factor in? And, oh, no, we don't want to put that line here. It needs to go down here. And you get into all those kinds of discussions.
It's very easy to say no when you're confused. Yes. And not only that, as a phrase I like to say all the time, which is that as models get more detailed and longer, often there's an illusion of accuracy that comes from that. Like people seem to assume, oh, if you've got 10,000 rows, gosh, this must be more accurate. But that's not necessarily the case. One of the things that we like to share and we talk about at the FMI is that every model has to tell a story. And the most important, maybe the most important job of any financial modeler is actually the ability to tell a story. Finance and accounting professionals don't often think that way. They don't often think of themselves as storytellers. But to your point, the most important thing that a modeler can do is is understand the whole system and then communicate that and convey it to their bosses, their decision makers. When I show up in front of a senior executive team, I want to spend a half an hour or less or whatever time it takes and walk them through in a compelling way. So at the end of it, they say, wow, this makes total sense. Yes, we're a go. It's clear. It's logical. We've got some videos on our website and on our YouTube page about what it means. There's a webinar that I've done on the top 10 skills of modelers. You can find that online as well to help make sure that your model tells a story, which creates enormous confidence with your reader and your boss. They can say, wow, I get it. I understand all of this. It's a beautiful system. And yes, we are ready to go. And that's one of the most difficult skills that people have to kind of get their heads around as modelers. It's not just about understanding accounting. It's not just about understanding how to use a spreadsheet. How do you build it in a way that talks, that flows, that tells a story that's compelling so people can really make the appropriate business decision?
One last big question. I'm reminded of a phenomenon that I've seen come up in the last 2 years with some of the global brands that I've had a chance to work with. And the discussion goes something like this. We would like to change our culture because we believe we are too slow to make decisions. We drive to capture 100% of the information that could inform that decision.
Yes.
But we have a sense that we could make a decision at a 70% accuracy mark.
Yes.
And not bear the burden of finding the other 30% of the content to go into the decision, or in this case, into the model. What do you guys talk about in terms of the veracity and comprehensive nature of the data that has to go into these models?
So first of all, I love the question. And I will not be so presumptuous to assume that a good model is enough to change corporate culture onto its own. However, it can help break the logjam of being caught up in, you know, data paralysis. You know, one of the most important, and we talked about this before the break, models have to have detail in terms of the operating row detail and also the vertical, the column detail. You know, and there's no right answer. Any model needs the right amount of detail that allows a team to make an effective decision. And so if there's, and you'll know that, if there's too much detail in a model that's unnecessary, it slows down decision making because people get drowned in the detail and they get pulled in by the detail and sucked in when it may make no difference. It may be irrelevant. You might sell 100 products. And so classic for me, a company will sell 100 different products. And so they'll build in 100 rows of sales volumes and 100 rows of pricing on each of those. And then 100 rows to multiply. So they have 300 rows just to figure out revenues. And then a manager might be prodding down and asking questions on row 97, which is a product that represents 0.01% of, you know, the business only because it's there. When in fact, you know, an insightful modeler will realize, wait a second, the top five products represent 85% of our revenue. Let's forecast those and capture all of the rest in one line called other. And let's focus on what matters, because no management team can control the future perfectly. And by the way, even if there are some things you can control perfectly, like locking in labor costs for the next 2 years, you can't control if there's going to be another global pandemic and the world's going to shut down. You can't control if inflation is going to go from 2% to 5% to 10%. You can't control if exchange rates are going to whipsaw. So you need the ability to say, what are the things we can control? What's out of our control? What's a range of reasonableness? And let's go. Let's make a decision.
Yeah.
I heard once, you know, people always talk about the importance of how. They talk about the importance of why and what. But in business, the most difficult decision to make is when. You know, a good business manager might know what we need to do and how we're going to get there. But the tough decision is when. You know, is it today? Do we wait another month, 2 months, 6 months? And by actually not making a decision and getting paralyzed in data, you are making a decision, which is not to act today. And you might be sacrificing the ability to move quickly with albeit less info, but make a better decision.
Right. Well, Ian, this has been great. And I know my brain's kind of in high gear already, but I'm going to have to shut it down and bring this to a close. And we talked on the break. We may actually do a second edition of this because I do think there's a lot more. So I'm going to ask everybody, if you're listening, leave us a comment if you would like to see a second part of this series so that we can get in here and get into some more details, and leave us your questions too as you're doing that. But Ian, tell everybody how they can get a hold of you if they're interested in learning more.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I mean, the easiest thing is just to follow me on LinkedIn. If you're on LinkedIn, it's Ian Schnoor, S-C-H-N-O-O-R. I actually am putting out a 10-part video series on the top 10 reasons people's balance sheets don't balance. So if you follow me, you'll see those come up. You can also go to the FMI, which is fminstitute.com. If you're not on LinkedIn, you can go to fminstitute.com. My email address is there on the biography page. So it's just ian.schnoor@fminstitute.com is how you can reach me. I'm easy to find. You Google me and it's not hard to find me or the Financial Modeling Institute, and would love to chat further if anyone has any questions or wants to be in touch. Thank you again, Doug, for having me on.
You bet. It's been a pleasure. And we'll have all that information in the show notes. And with that, I want to remind everybody, if you're listening via audio to this episode, you can also hop over to my YouTube channel of the same name, Leadership Powered by Common Sense, and look for the video version. And you'll get an opportunity to look at the other shows and episodes that are out there as well. And that, too, is another good place you can leave a note or leave a comment for us so that we can assess that next opportunity, which I got a feeling is going to happen. We'll talk about that offline here, but great. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. You are listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I'm your host, Doug Thorpe, and it's been a pleasure visiting with you. Hope to see you again real soon.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.